Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Girl, real talk. This whole it's new year, time to reinvent myself trash is not the vibe for 2024. You can find someone who loves you for you, as you are. You don't need to read a stack of self-help books, only eat sad salads, or like start meditating at 5 a.m. to be ready for dating. So, yeah, my advice is to download Bumble and find someone who embraces you the way you are right now. Let me know how it goes.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Big box retailers, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a bill in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. Senate Bill 1838 would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, visit handsoffmyrewards.com and tell them to oppose credit card routing legislation paid for by the Electronic Payments Coalition.
The teleology of our lives became toward a crisis of some kind, which would allow then for a rebirth of some kind. The problem with that teleology is that it requires a crisis in order to be fulfilled, right? And so, you know, you can't have a comeback unless there was, you know, this failure of some sort.
I'm Jordan Kissner, author of the essay collection Thin Places, and this is Thresholds, a weekly series of conversations with writers and artists about moments of epiphany or transformation that changed their lives and their work. A moment that they stepped across, like a threshold, into something new, and the way that experience changed everything they wrote afterward. I first met Greg Pardlow in graduate school. We were both studying nonfiction, and he was this kind of quiet, incredibly kind, thoughtful colleague and classmate. And one morning, we all came in for class and everyone was sitting around the table and someone had read in the paper that Greg, this Greg, had just been awarded the Pulitzer Prize for poetry. He hadn't even mentioned that he was a poet. The collection that won him the Pulitzer is titled Digest. And a few years after that, he published a beautiful memoir titled Air Traffic about his father, who was an air traffic controlman and a labor organizer who lost his job following the famous air traffic controller strike of 1981. The book is about that event and then all the ways that it and Greg's relationship with his father reverberated through their family life. Greg's work is published widely. He's the poetry editor of the Virginia Quarterly Review, and right now he's teaching for NYU in Abu Dhabi, where I caught up with him about writing, about sobriety, and about learning to commit to a process of transformation when you can't even begin to imagine how it will turn out in the end.
I think my life boils down to two kind of before and after moments. One was the air traffic control strike, when my father lost his job and, you know, my family fortunes, as such as they were, dissipated overnight. And then me getting sober in 2011. In 1981, my father was an air traffic controller, and one of the, as you can imagine, in the 70s, one of very few African-American air traffic controllers. And he was also something of a social activist, and labor gave him an opportunity, that the labor union gave him an opportunity to bring together his class and race. Mission in life. So he was active in the air traffic controllers union, and that activism filtered into our family life in ways that were foundational for me. You know, it's kind of forming the landscape, my moral landscape. So I identified very deeply with not only my father's obviously racial politics, but his class politics as well. So when the Air Traffic Controllers Union went on strike against the federal government, and I guess to give a little more background, the air traffic controllers were largely did not require a college degree to get that job. And most of them, men in very, overwhelming majority of cases, were otherwise would not have had as well paying a job as that if it weren't for the opportunity that the federal government created in hiring them. Or so went the logic of the federal government. Ronald Reagan, who was president at the time, very new president. He was inaugurated in January. The strike occurred in August. Felt that the air traffic controllers, who wanted, more regular hours, they wanted better pay, they wanted better working conditions, and had had little success with previous administrations. At this point, decided they were going to go on strike. They'd had enough, and they felt like they were out of options. And so Ronald Reagan, now confronted with this strike, needed to make his bones, so to speak, as a gun, kind of straight shooting cowboy politician that he, sort of postured as. Rather than negotiate with the union, he fired 13,000 federal employees. And so what was nonetheless, despite all the, what the air traffic controllers felt, what was nonetheless a very good job was now no job with no pension, no benefits. And, and my mother was working, but my father was by far the breadwinner of the family. And so, we had this very particular image of ourselves as upwardly mobile, black middle-class family. And all the resources necessary to maintain that self-image were overnight removed. And it took some time to kind of admit to ourselves that they were not coming back. And that in a existential trauma stayed with me the idea of the way I've thought it through in the book was I began to look at these kind of moments of hitting rock bottom, so to speak, moments of transformation when something's got to give, and either the individual changes or is forced to change. And I'm talking about myself or members of my family. So it was a long-winded way of kind of laying the groundwork of how I think about this repetition compulsion. And I think in a way that narrative has turned up, bad penny like several times in my life, not only in the sense, in a very real sense, but also as in the way that I think about narrativizing my life, right? How do I tell the story of my life? And it has fit very comfortably in my imagination into a kind of story of repetition.
In the book, you talk about how you sort of construct, in a way, the journey of your sobriety, or maybe your journey towards sobriety, as something that almost is, it feels, when I was reading it, it felt like it was almost like set off, like you lit the match to a very long fuse of, you know, it, with the strike, but then it sort of brought you toward the moment of sobriety. Mm. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think in a way that's this trick of writing that I'm talking about. I don't know if there's any real connection, right? And in a sense, that's contrived. I'm telling the story in a way to suggest that the strike and made my sobriety an inevitability. I mean, made my alcoholism and eventual sobriety an inevitability. And the reason for this is, or the rationale behind it, is that my father's kind of collapse of his self-image kind of defined the way I saw the story of my family, and necessarily in that, the story of myself, as being kind of the teleology of our lives was toward some sort of, became toward a crisis of some kind, which would allow then for a rebirth of some kind. I think in the book, the kind of epiphany that I was hoping for, and I don't think arrived, and I say I don't think because I'm trying to remember, if it's been a couple of years since I was deep into the book. But it set up this the problem with that teleology is that it requires a crisis in order to be fulfilled, right? And so you can't have a comeback unless there was, you know, this failure of some sort. And so part of the pursuit of health that the memoir narrative presumes of, in this case, in my book, in this case, is an awareness that I am prefiguring crises, you know, serial crises, and that I need to imagine a new story of myself that would allow for what we started talking about, and that is a threshold without, that does not require suffering or some kind of trauma in order to cross it.
In the 90s, ads for phone sex lines could be seen everywhere, flickering on late night cable channels and printed on the back of magazines. Phone sex operators worked around the clock to fulfill fantasies. It all started with an idea from a guy named Mike Pardes, CEO and founder of American Telnet. But it was the women behind the phones who created the close-knit yet dysfunctional family that turned American Telnet into a multi-billion dollar company and revolutionized the sex industry. Wondery and Topic Studios' new podcast, Operator, is the untold story of Telnet, which dominated the phone sex industry until the money blinded them and it all came crashing down. I actually heard about this show a couple years ago when it was in development, and I am so excited to finally be getting to listen to it now. Follow Operator on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or you can listen early and ad-free by subscribing to Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Big box retailers, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a bill in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. Senate Bill 1838 would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, visit handsoffmyrewards.com and tell them to oppose credit card routing legislation paid for by the Electronic Payments Coalition.
Did you experience sobriety as, at the time, as the kind of rebirth or productive, you know, reincarnation post-crisis that you imagined it to be? Like, did you think at the time that you had reached the last one?
No, that's a great question. No, I think what that particular crisis taught me was that was the kind of falseness of previous crises, right? The because I, as I say, some crises, like, you know, quitting my jobs or you know, crashing my cars or, you know, breaking up with loved ones, and relationships, these were all contrived crises, and I would enter into them with the anticipation of this rebirth afterwards, right? Mm. And so, you know, there's this perpetual shooting myself in the foot. But the learning, or the lesson of sobriety was that there, I could not imagine what was on the other side of it in order for it to be of, in order for it to be the threshold that it actually was. So I,
do you mean
I
you back, like you literally, you truly couldn't, or you felt like you shouldn't?
I think both, and I'm trying to figure out, if there's a distinction there, because it wasn't the first time I attempted to get sober. I think previous times that I tried to get sober, I would imagine when I imagined a life post sobriety, you know, or post rock bottom, that process of imagining my life would cause me to get to drink again. Because I didn't like the life that it was imagining. I didn't want that life. I wanted a life in which I could still, you know, drink myself into oblivion on occasion. Using air quotes there. So part of the necessary process was not imagining what was on the other side, giving up a desire to know what was on the other side. As I'm talking about this, I hear myself talking about the writing process very much, you know, and entering into a poem. As soon as I try and predetermine, you know, this is what the poem is going to say, it falls on its face, and there's a kind of faith that I've been, I don't know, toying with isn't the word, but kind of cozying up to. I don't know if it's a function of my age. I don't know if it's a you know, what it is, but there is I've been expanding my idea of what constitutes faith, and in that is a notion of trusting what's on the other side. And not needing to construct it imaginatively in my mind ahead of time.
How does that fit in to writing for you? Like, how do these ideas map onto writing for you?
Mm-hmm. So I've been thinking about the writing, both in the macro sense and in terms of a career, and in the micro sense and in the terms of, you know, this project here. I think I don't like to take commissions because I don't trust my ability to construct something that is not sort of self-serving in the end. So, in other words, if you ask me to write a poem about X, I will probably write a decent poem. I could do it, but I think in my mind there's a distrust of myself and my ego, and there's a years of therapy. I'm kind of tender around the ego, and it's, I think that's probably the biggest obstacle to my writing. There, I'm juxtaposing the ego and kind of what I'm calling now faith. And the ego needs to know what the outcome is, needs security, the security of knowing. The ego wants to decide ahead of time who the characters are, right? And we see this in life. You know, the ego needs to presume to know who one is speaking to, let's say. The faith mind, and which is I am now imagining as the artistic mind, is, let's go of the need to know, and very Keatsian, you know, and sits in the indeterminacy. It sits comfortable, makes itself comfortable with the mystery. And I don't know if that's a, I don't know how to make that a, if that's a practice, a part of my writing practice, but it's clearly a core part of my writing ethos. And I want to sit down to work and get the ego out of the way, however possible, so that I can be open to contradiction, surprise, play, delight, joy, sadness. And I think the ego doesn't want to experience any of these things. And it's various levels of needing to know too. So it's not just needing to know how the poem, let's say if I'm writing a poem, how the poem's going to turn out. But it's needing to, it turns into, and I'm so embarrassed even to say these things, but it turns into, and I also recognize it's very common, imagining how it plays out, it's going to play out in social media, imagining, you know, what's the narrative going to be, you know, basically marketing the thing before I've even written the thing. And so this is a struggle, and I don't pretend to have made any great headway with it. It is something I find very distasteful in my work, and so I'm hyper vigilant. Possibly to the point of you know, overcompensation. But to your question, how do I get out of the ego? You know, it's the internal bullshit monitor. It's the, you know, it's the in terms of sobriety, it's you know, what is it in the big book that took I don't even remember how it goes, but taking account of myself, taking an inventory and being a kind of fearless and in my self-criticism and honest in my self-criticism.
That's the language in the big book from AA.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. As I recall, it's mm-hmm. been a while. And I don't think one ever, I certainly don't expect ever to achieve, you know, that level of enlightenment. And I don't think it exists, but I do think I'm coming back to this idea, this image of the carrot on the stick. You know, I want to challenge my ideas. I want to keep questioning, asking myself, is it necessary? You know, what God are you serving, Pardlo, when you write X? You know, what is it? And I mean that both in the kind of spiritual sense or intellectual sense and a secular sense. In the secular sense, that the work is always couched in ideologies, and I want to be conscious of the cultural assumptions and the kind of nefarious ways that we virtue signal in society, and how I've picked, you know, I've certainly picked up the various ways of virtue signaling, and in a craft conversation, in terms of craft, I think the kind of work that I admire is aware of the frames that, how do I say this? So when I'm teaching, I tell my students, you know, every poem has its own cartoon physics, borrowing this term from Nick Flynn. In this poem, this poem creates a world in which you can run off the cliff and it'll take you 3 seconds before you plummet. And in this world, you can paint a black hole on the rock and walk through it. So every poem, and I'm using poem just because it's easy to talk about for me, but I think this is true of any text. Every poem has its own cultural assumptions. And I think growing up in an educational context in which I was aware of cultural assumptions that many of my classmates were not aware of, or, you know, just because they could not see it, they had not been excluded from it in a way that I had been excluded from them. I'm sensitive to the ways that we assume that the world created by the text is a real world, right? It is fact. And as Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, for example, very famously points out the danger of the single story. There is no such thing as one story. There are an infinite number of perspectives. There are facts, absolutely. But the story itself is always a contrivance. It is always artifice. And so when I'm sitting down to write, I want to be as aware of the ways I'm protecting me, the author, Greg Pardlo, the ways I may be protecting my I character, as we recall from our beloved classes with Philip Lopate, how we may be contributing or complicit in imagining a world that will appeal to a reader's sense of security. And which is not to say that when I write, I want to upset my reader's sense of security, but I strive to be as conscious of the as many cultural assumptions as I can, as a way of giving myself the options of, you know, there are complicities that are necessary in the writing process. I'm complicit in writing in English, you know, most obviously. But I want to be aware of the choices that I'm making as a way of sort of being conscious of, as I say, what gods I'm serving when I'm writing.
And how does that fit in, or does it fit in with this idea we've sort of been touching on of negative capability or of faith? Because it sounds like what you're talking about is an act of like intentional, supreme awareness. And yet also sometimes if we're going to borrow Keats's language, the sort of act of negative capability or of faith, as you're describing it in writing, to me feels like it requires maybe some suspension of your self-awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I had a kind of defining conversation with a student once who reminded me, and I've had this conversation with many students, but this is a kind of archetypal conversation where the student says something like, well, I don't want to, I'm afraid of getting healthy because then I'll have nothing to write about, or right, you know, I'm afraid of solving these problems. But my response to that is there is absolutely no possibility of fully knowing ourselves. There will always be mystery. And I think that's part of the foundation that I'm calling faith, is I think ultimately I cannot imagine a situation in which we talked about this at the beginning of the hour, I cannot imagine a situation in which I will sit back and say, yeah, I've got myself all figured out. There will always be, just because time is what it is, there will always be an element of mystery in my own head. And I want to respect that mystery and sort of honor it. So in terms of the writing process, I think about it like, if I'm sitting in my chair at my desk here, and I draw this kind of imaginary perimeter, a rainbow shape around myself on the desktop, and I say, what is inside this arc is what I know of myself. This is what I confidently know. I confidently know, you know, I can string together some rhyming sounds that are going to be pleasant, and I got a pretty decent sense of rhythm, and I know I can do that. And I also know that I've got a handle on some elements of my experience in life and some elements of pedagogy, and so I'm pretty confident that I can communicate this range of ideas fairly clearly and compellingly, which is not to pat myself on the back. I'm just, you know, this is where my confidence is. If I'm writing within that range of confidence, then I'm not really pushing myself. I'm not really doing the thing that I want my work to be doing. I want to be writing, for so long it was, in my family, it's often thought of as a bad thing, to, and I think in many circumstances is thought of as a bad thing, to talk about shit you don't know anything about. But I think in this case, I very much want to be writing at the edge of my understanding, at the edge of my self-awareness, of my awareness of the world. I want to be writing just in the area where I'm not so sure I have this figured out. The problem with that is, you know, the world, you know, readers, as I say, in most cases don't want to listen to somebody figuring it out. And we want very much leadership from our authors and poets. We want declarative statements. And I don't know, I'm kind of, I don't know if it's fair to blame readers. I'm in all honesty, my father, this is my father speaking in the back of my head. My father wants clarity. My father wants certainty. And I think that's what I'm pushing back against in my writing practice. Is I want the permission. I want to give myself the permission to speculate, to explore. And I'm conscious of the kind of dangers of that, but that's how I thread that needle between being the pursuit of self-awareness, and hopefully that arc will be constantly growing and moving. Well, it has to be, but I will also, in my process, I want to keep writing. I want to keep striving toward the outer perimeters of that arc.
Was getting sober your first leap of that kind? Is that sort of sounded like that's what you were saying earlier, where it was your first sort of gesture of really making a big move without sort of on faith like that? And if the answer is yes, like how did that open a space for you to really be able to do that in a new way in your writing?
Well, the second part of that question, the first part is emphatically yes. The second part, I still don't know, and I don't want to know. What I do know is that the kind of surrender that was necessary, the continual surrender that is necessary in remaining sober and maintaining a sense of sobriety, which not coincidentally has everything to do with getting out from behind the ego. I can see things in my work that I couldn't see before. And I'm able to, I think that if I go back to my perimeter analogy, I think that perimeter was stagnant for most of my adult life. And it loosened up and became kind of pliable and living thing after post sobriety, and so I'm engaging with the world in a way that is less, certainly less rigid. I think pre-sobriety was necessarily rigid because I had so many lies I had to preserve, right? And so when one starts to shift around the untruths, then the whole thing begins to crumble. But I think what's benefited my work in sobriety is the allowing. Allowing myself to live, to be in relation to I'm just reaching for abstractions here. I'm not sure entirely
how to articulate it, but there's a, and harmony is not the word either, but there's a kind of dancing relationship to ideas, to people, to belief systems and value systems that I have in as a sober thinker that I could not have imagined when I was drinking.
Threshold is a production of LitHub Radio. We're produced by Drew Broussard and Justin Alvarez. Music and editing by Laura Faye Oshwood of Arthur Moon. Our art is by Kirsten Huber. Special thanks to Farrar, Strauss, and Drew. I'm Jordan Kissner. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at jordan.kissner. We'll see you next week.